great to be back with you. On my mind this week, many people have said the key issue for voters who put Donald Trump into the White House is the economy and whether the president can deliver on his campaign promises of more and better jobs. So first, I talk with David Wessel of the Brookings Institution about the Fed's rate increase, our economy, and the White House budget numbers. Then, Washington Post columnist Catherine Rampell on the dangers of conspiracy theories.
In a way, I think the ones that are more insidious are not the Ted Cruz's dad killed Kennedy kind of thing, but more this attempt to wear down the trust in institutions and in our sources of accountability.
But first, David Wessel of the Brookings Institution. David, it's good to have you with us.
How are you liking the new pace of life?
Oh, I love it. It's just wonderful. David, we're finally seeing some concerted steps from the Fed to inch up the fund rates. The economy is good. Apparently, the Fed thinks it's going to get better. Tell me how consumers are going to be affected by this rate hike.
Well, you're absolutely right that what the Fed is telling us is that they are finally confident in their economic forecast that the economy is getting better. They thought this in 2015. They were wrong. They thought this in 2016. They were wrong. Now they're much more confident. So the good news for consumers at first is that the Federal Reserve think the economy is getting better, and you can see that in most of the data on the job market. Unemployment is down. More people are feeling comfortable enough that they can find another job that they're quitting and so forth. So when the Fed raises interest rates because the economy is strong, on one hand, it's a good thing because it means finally we're out of this mess we've been in for the past couple of years, or we're closer to getting out of it. But it will mean that you pay more if you borrow money. Mortgage rates moved up in anticipation of this. They're now at about 4.2% for a 30-year mortgage. They were below 4% just a few months ago.
Right.
People who have credit cards and borrow on their credit cards, those rates adjust very quickly when the Federal Reserve raises short-term interest rates. Same thing with auto loans. And eventually, although somehow it always takes longer, banks will raise the interest rate that they give you on your savings, on your certificate and deposit, and money market funds will also see a little bit of an increase. But interest rates are still extraordinarily low.
You know, it's always troubled me that the people who are going to earn more interest because of the rate hikes have to wait longer.
Yeah, funny thing how that works.
I think that
for a long time, the banks have been complaining that interest rates were so low and that they couldn't make much money on the difference between what they pay and what they get when they lend money. So they're going to take advantage of this opportunity to widen their profit margins a little bit.
Okay. And, of course, President Trump has made some mighty strong statements about how much he can grow the economy. Tell us what his projections have been and how they compare with what other economists are saying about how much the economy can grow.
Right. President Trump hasn't actually issued a formal economic forecast. Even in the budget he just put out, or the mini budget, or the skinny mini budget, or whatever you want to call it, there isn't a traditional economic forecast. But we understand that his people are hoping to get growth up towards 3%, and he's talked about 4% over the next couple of years. That's a lot more than the Fed is expecting and a lot more than most economists expect. Most people in the business of trying to guess at these things think the economy can safely grow at maybe 2.25% a year. And the reason they think that is because economic growth over the long run is a pretty simple sum of how much we can increase the workforce and how much people each make for each hour of work. The workforce isn't growing very fast because we're getting older and more people are retiring, and we're not having enough kids to replace the people who are retiring. And President Trump certainly doesn't seem to want to encourage a lot of immigration. And productivity growth, the amount of extra stuff we get for each hour of work, has been really disappointing. So even if it goes up a little from where we are, it's hard to see us getting much above 2.25% without some real radical change in the way the economy is functioning.
Okay, but don't higher interest rates actually put something of a brake on the economy?
Well, what the Fed is saying is the economy is now growing fast enough so we can begin to take our foot off the accelerator. As Janet Yellen said at her press conference, interest rates are still low, so we're not putting our foot on the brakes. We're just pulling back on the accelerator a little bit. There's a limit to how fast the economy can grow, and we are approaching that limit. What the Fed wants to avoid is having too much demand in the economy, so instead of getting economic growth, we get inflation. It's a very tricky balance, and I think that what the Fed is trying to say is we can't grow the economy much faster right now, so we're beginning to pull our foot off the accelerator very gently, and we would be thrilled if President Trump and Congress could do things that might lead us to allow faster growth in the future. That would mean perhaps investment in infrastructure spending. It might mean deregulation. It might mean better education. It might be more incentives to bring people into the workforce, whatever would increase the safe rate of growth, the kind of speed limit rate of growth, if you will.
I think that word safe rate of growth is where you've got both the Fed and the White House somewhat in conflict.
Absolutely. What I'm watching is someone who's covered this for a long time. You know, ever since Bill Clinton, so that's Bill Clinton, the second George Bush, and Barack Obama, the White House has been very quiet about criticizing the Fed, even if it wasn't always happy with what the Fed did. They kind of thought that it was better for the world if they had their criticism behind closed doors, didn't upset the financial markets, they didn't undermine the independence of the Fed by criticizing them. I find it very hard to believe that will be the case in the Trump administration. I expect that at some point the economy will disappoint. President Trump will be eager to find someone to blame. The Fed, which will be raising interest rates, will be a wonderful target for him. And we'll wake up one morning, Janet Yellen will be looking at her smartphone and seeing Donald Trump tweeting criticism of her. I think that's almost baked in the cake.
But she is there for a set number of years, is she not?
Well, Diane, her term ends February 1st, 2018. So she's there for less than a year. President Trump can replace her.
How many others go off the Fed?
The Federal Reserve Board in Washington is seven people appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. There are two vacancies now, and there'll be a third one in a couple of weeks. So President Trump will get to nominate three people to the Federal Reserve Board in Washington soon, and he'll be able to replace both the chair, Janet Yellen, and the vice chair, Stan Fisher, early next year. So he'll get a chance to remake the Federal Reserve Board. Now, there is one check on this system. The interest rates are set by a committee, and the committee includes the presidents of the 12 Federal Reserve banks out there in the rest of the country, five of whom can vote at any one meeting. And those people are not appointed by the president. Hmm. They're appointed by their private sector boards of directors with the okay of the Federal Reserve Board in Washington. And that will be an important restraint on how much the president can muscle the Fed.
Okay, David, but now let's talk about the tax cuts that President Trump wants to put into effect and infrastructure spending. How are those two things likely to affect what the Fed itself does?
If the president can move swiftly, and if Congress can move swiftly, and as you know, Diane, those are two really big ifs, so that we got tax cuts, putting money into the economy quickly, infrastructure spending, remember the old shovel-ready myth, showing up in the economy quickly, then I think the Fed would raise interest rates more rapidly than it's currently planning. So they are saying maybe two more interest rate increases this year. If the Congress moved very rapidly and they thought the money was going to hit the economy soon, they'd probably raise interest rates more because they think we're at that safe or speed limit rate of growth. However, as I read the situation right now, it doesn't look like Congress is going to be moving very quickly to approve any tax cuts or big spending increases. So I think this is probably likely to be a 2018 or 2019 issue for the Fed.
And what about the Fed selling off bonds? It's built up over the last 8 years.
As you know, the Federal Reserve cut interest rates to zero, which was extraordinary. And then they decided that wasn't enough to help the economy recover. So they bought trillions of dollars in bonds in order to lower long-term interest rates. And right now, they've been holding that steady. Every time a bond comes due, they buy a new one. We don't know when exactly they'll move, but it seems likely that sometime at the end of this year or maybe early in 2018, the Fed will say, we're going to gradually let our portfolio shrink. That is, when a bond comes due, a treasury note or a mortgage-backed security, we won't replace it. I think it'll be a very gentle process, and I don't think they'll look at that as a separate tool of monetary policy. But it is an issue they're going to have to deal with, and they said they would deal with it when they managed to get interest rates up above, say, 1%, and they're getting close to that point.
And how is the Congress and the White House likely to act if they do begin selling off that stash of bonds?
I don't think that there'll be much reaction as long as the financial markets take it calmly. There are a lot of people in Congress who criticize the Fed for buying all these bonds, and they'd be happy to see the portfolio shrink. And other people will be more focused on the short-term interest rate and the health of the economy. So if the Fed feels comfortable enough to let its portfolio of bonds shrink, that will happen only if the economy is doing well. And if I'm a member of Congress, I'll be far more worried than that. I mean, how many people in America even know what the Fed did with quantitative easing, buying the bonds? I don't think it's going to be a big deal.
Tell me about jobs, David. Do you think President Trump can really deliver on the jobs he's promised?
I think it'll be very difficult. We've created a lot of jobs over the last several years because we had a lot of unused capacity in the economy. We had a lot of workers who wanted to work, and we had businesses that had been reluctant to hire for a while. Businesses have done quite a bit of hiring, and we're reaching the point where it's going to be difficult to sustain the kind of 200,000 jobs we've had each month going forward. There's just not going to be enough opportunities, and there's not going to be enough workers for that. I think what will be much more important is, well, two things will be important. One is the president has made a big point of manufacturing jobs. Now, they're a relatively small part of the economy, but they get a lot of attention, and he made a big deal of going to all these plants. So if manufacturing jobs pick up, which is possible, that'll be good, and I'm sure he'll take credit for every hire. But if they don't, if the carrier plant turns out to have fewer workers a year from now than it did a year ago, I think that'll hurt him. But the second thing is wages, right? Most people in America who want to work have jobs, but they've been upset that their wages are rising so slowly. Wages have just recently begun to pick up for the typical worker. And if the Fed puts the brakes on too soon, if we get more inflation than the Fed anticipates, I think that will really upset people. I think they thought, not only am I going to be able to keep my job, and my son or daughter who just got out of college will be able to get a job, but I'm going to get my wages going up. And by the way, I'd like not to get my health insurance taken away at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. All right, one last question, and that is about a very big subject, the proposed budget plan that the White House has apparently put forward. Big cuts to the EPA, big cuts to the State Department. What do you make of it?
Well, it's fascinating what the White House is doing here. Basically, they're not giving us a budget as a whole. They're not saying we're going to give tax cuts to some people and cut spending somewhere else, and so there's some good and some bad. Basically, what they're saying is America first, in budget terms, means we're going to spend more money on defense, more money on veterans, and less money on everything else. The cuts are very deep. They remind me of some of the stuff that Ronald Reagan talked about. He is proposing to cut things that are popular in Congress, like spending for medical research, and he's proposing to cut things that, in my opinion, Trump voters will depend on. I think they will be disappointed when they discover there's less money for job training, or that the Superfund site in their community won't be cleaned up, or that their local government's going to get less money for transportation grants and stuff. So I don't think Congress is going to accept this. I don't think it's coherent. And I think it's almost like budget by bumper sticker. The president wants to be able to give a speech at a rally and say, I'm not going to let them spend your tax money on National Public Radio. We're not going to spend your tax money for foreign aid when we have problems here. But it's such a small part of the budget. It's only 1/6 the federal spending. It doesn't deal with the real economic issues of the country. It doesn't spur growth. And it doesn't deal with the deficit or the debt. Other than that, it's okay.
Other than that, it's okay. David Wesley, it's always a joy to talk with you. Thank you very much for being with me.
You're welcome, Diane.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Joining me by phone from New York, Washington Post columnist Catherine Rampell. Catherine, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Your piece in the Washington Post this week, you wrote that it's time to invest in tinfoil. Tell us what you mean.
What I mean is that many members of the Trump administration, starting with the boss, but going on down to much lower-ranked political appointees, have taken an extreme interest in conspiracy theories. This was true throughout the campaign, but also true once they took office. And when I was referring to tinfoil, I was referring to the tinfoil hat they all appear to be wearing.
And those tinfoil hats, you think, would either protect them or help them convey their message to the American people?
Well, there appears to be a lot of paranoia in the White House these days. So, you know, I meant tinfoil hats, obviously metaphorically, but pretty somewhere on the border, I would say, between metaphor and literalism, in that earlier this week, actually over the weekend, Kellyanne Conway, who is obviously a White House advisor, made a comment suggesting that Trump Tower may have been under surveillance during the campaign through microwaves and televisions. So when she was asked, you know, is there any evidence that Trump Tower was wiretapped, she referred to that. She subsequently, after receiving widespread mockery, backed off of those comments and said she had no evidence that she was being videotaped through the microwave. You know, it's a sort of a silly example, but I think it's emblematic of the comments and attitudes of many members of this administration who, again, engage in conspiracy theories and promulgate various kind of crackpot theories about Pizzagate, about the deep state, about lots of other, at the very least, dubious theories about what's going on in the world.
You know, I was surprised that even the budget director, Mick Mulvaney, said the Obama administration had been manipulating the jobs numbers.
Yes, and actually, in a way, I think those kind of comments are the most pernicious, in that we can kind of laugh off to some extent these comments about being surveilled through microwaves or crazy theories that Hillary Clinton was involved in a child sex ring run through a pizza parlor. But these other conspiracy theories, like Mick Mulvaney's, that deliberately discredit or attempt to discredit very important institutions within the U.S., particularly within the U.S. government, that serve as a check on how policymakers are doing, that serve as a source of accountability. That, I think, is the most pernicious. In this particular instance, Mulvaney suggested that the Obama administration had been manipulating the unemployment numbers. You know, the unemployment numbers have been calculated the exact same way, more or less, since 1940. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has its process for analyzing and distilling the data. The actual surveys are conducted by the Census Bureau, but, you know, they do this in conjunction. These numbers have been around for a very long time, but there have been these sort of data truthers out there for several years suggesting that the numbers are politically manipulated. Not only the unemployment numbers, but you may recall that during the financial crisis and immediately afterward, there were these inflation truthers who claimed that there was secret hyperinflation that wasn't being reported. So these theories have been around for a while, and a lot of Americans buy into them.
Exactly. Aren't they precisely why Trump got elected? Because people believe exactly the kinds of things that you're referring to that were said during the campaign.
Yes. Trump made no secret of his interest in conspiracy theories. Again, whether they're the more colorful ones like Ted Cruz's father was involved in the JFK assassination, or
Hillary Clinton, as you mentioned, was involved in this child sex scandal, which came out from Breitbart.
Oh, and let's not forget the very foundation of his involvement in the political scene, which was birtherism, claiming that our first black president was illegitimate because he was secretly born in Kenya. This is how Trump got his start. And some of these conspiracy theories are, like I said, crazy and colorful, and a lot of people believe them, but it's also kind of easy to laugh them off because they're so nutty. In a way, I think the ones that are more insidious are not the, you know, Ted Cruz's dad killed Kennedy kind of thing, but more this attempt to wear down the trust in institutions and in our sources of accountability, whether they're the media or our independent federal statistical agencies, which we need and rely on to help us assess how the economy is doing. Financial markets use this information to figure out how to price things and how to function. And if we can no longer agree on a common set of metrics and facts, that's very destructive, you know, both to the economy and society as a whole.
But, Catherine, how do you explain the fact that his supporters, no matter what, are not thrown off by any of this? In fact, it seems to gain Donald Trump even more support. He was recently in Nashville, and, I mean, they came out in droves, absolutely believing he's going to create more jobs for them. He's going to be able to create better salaries for them, all the things he campaigned on. And then he comes out with all of these contradictory remarks, and yet his supporters go along with it.
I think there are a few ways to interpret these patterns. One is that there are a lot of Americans who feel like they've been ignored, and they feel like Donald Trump is speaking to them. And policy is complicated. You know, it's technical. Most people, understandably, do not have the time to follow the nitty-gritty of the healthcare debate or various other economic policies, tax reform, et cetera. So when he says, "I have your back," they believe him. You know, he seems like he speaks to their worldview and their needs, and they trust that he has their interests at heart. And it's difficult to actually follow up right now with whether the plans that he's proposing actually address these promises that he has made.
On the other hand, in regard to health care, he promised that everyone would be covered with affordable health care. And now the Congressional Budget Office has come out with a report on the Trump health care plan saying 24 million people will be thrown off health care. How do his supporters sort of justify that with what he said during the campaign?
In the same way that these independent federal statistical agencies have been attacked and have been basically undermined by rhetoric from Trump as well, and not just Trump, of course, you know, many other politicians as well, particularly Republicans in Congress right now. The Congressional Budget Office, which produced these estimates, has also been under siege in that the White House, as well as congressional leadership, has questioned the numbers. And these forecasts are never perfect, right? Predicting the future is very challenging. There are a lot of unknown unknowns. But traditionally, if the word of the CEO was not exactly gospel, it was used as a respected benchmark for judging the effects of legislation. This time around, politicians are saying, Trump is saying, oh, don't trust those numbers. They're bogus. They're baloney. The CBO gets everything wrong. So right now, Trump supporters can hear this rhetoric and say, well, Trump says this legislation is going to help me. Trump says it'll make healthcare more affordable and more people will be covered and nobody will be dying in the streets. I trust that guy. I don't trust those propeller heads on Capitol Hill. What happens in the future, of course, is a little dicier. So right now, these are just forecasts. And if you don't trust the experts, then you can take Trump at his word. I think that's dangerous, of course, especially since when those many millions of people lose their health insurance, maybe it'll be 24, maybe it'll be 15, who knows? It will be, we know the direction of the change, if not the exact magnitude, you know, even if we have estimates. When all these people lose health insurance, they're going to be angry. Right now, it's easy for them to continue supporting their candidate who says that he has their backs. But once these policies actually take effect and influence their lives and their pocketbooks, they may not be so supportive anymore.
But ironically, apparently the one idea that Trump doesn't think could be true is that Russia intervened in any way with the 2016 election campaign.
Right. It's a bit ironic, right, that this administration is riddled with these conspiracy theories and crackpot stories about Pizzagate and birtherism and everything else. But the one conspiracy theory that's beyond the pale is the idea that the Russians maybe, just maybe, intervened in this election to help put Trump in the White House. You know, that's where the line is drawn, not about data manipulation, not about 3 million people voting illegally. Nope. The thing that we actually have evidence for, that Russia intervened, the intelligence agencies have said, in order to influence this election in a particular direction. Nope, that's getting carried away.
So from your perspective as a columnist, how do we pull back into some kind of fact-based world?
It's very challenging. The media environment and media and diets, you know, amongst consumers are very fragmented right now. And so you do have these parallel universes of facts. So people like me might trust the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and other statistical agencies, the Congressional Budget Office, as, you know, if imperfect, the best scientifically available information. But for those who distrust all of these institutions, they can construct their own universe of parallel facts and numbers, and I don't know how you jump the divide. It's very challenging right now. The challenge for columnists like myself is how do you reach people without insulting them, but reach people who disagree with you, who don't trust the statistics that you rely on? How do you convince them that there are authoritative sources out there when they're not inclined to believe that? And I don't know the answer. It's something that I struggle with a lot. Some of it is just listening to people and what their concerns are.
Yes.
But, you know, the way that media consumption is set up right now doesn't really lend itself to that dialogue. It's hard for me to have these kinds of conversations with people who, again, distrust what I would view as longstanding important sources of accountability. How do I have a dialogue with them, not talk at them, which I think is what it often feels like, but listen to them, respond to their concerns, and say, here's why I think these kinds of conspiracy theories are unfounded. So it's challenging right now.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. The way to begin is to listen and then present what you know. And I thank you so much for sharing with us what you know, Catherine Rampell. It's good to talk with you.
Thank you for having me. Anytime.
For this week from the archives, more on conspiracy theories. In May of 2011, I spoke with Jonathan Kay about his book, Among the Truthers. He explains why conspiracy theories gained in popularity in the U.S. and how Donald Trump fits in.
The Kennedy assassination, obviously one of the most focused on issues in the history of human news coverage. And by one study, about 2,000 books about the assassination, most of them dwelling on some conspiratorial element, some theory, the mafia, Cubans, and that sort of thing. But what's interesting about that is it took years and decades for those books to come out. And they were written usually by solitary authors. With the internet, that's changed completely because, first of all, the speed. You know, after the announcement that Osama bin Laden had been killed, I immediately went to some of my conspiracy theory websites that I monitor, and within hours, there were already elaborate theories about how bin Laden was still alive. In the JFK era, it took months or years for these theories to develop. Now, they appear in hours. And also, it's now a collaborative enterprise. You know, it's not one guy sitting creating his conspiracy theory. Now, it's groups of people creating YouTube videos, blogging on each other's sites, putting comments. It's become a collective enterprise, and it's part of the social media on Facebook pages and stuff. This is a socially constructed universe now.
But do they believe what they're saying?
The only exception I found, I think, might be Donald Trump, for whom I think conspiracy theories are a sort of marketing enterprise. You know, in my book, I take it for granted that the conspiracy theorists that I interviewed genuinely believe these theories, but Donald Trump might be the only exception who's a guy who's actually just trying to market himself to people who believe these theories.
Or he doesn't. And I didn't think this was such a big deal, but I will tell you, it's turning out to be a very big deal because people now are calling me from all over saying, please don't give up on this issue. If you weren't born in this country, you cannot be president.
But do you think he was born in this country?
I am really concerned.
You can listen to that entire show on DianeRein.org. That's our show for the week. As always, we want to hear from you. I want to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851 or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. I'm Diane Rehm. Thanks, and I'll talk to you next week.